This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, the freshmen will be sworn in. The members take their seats and the 109th Congress gets underway. Ahead lie debates about Social Security and the tax code, tort reform, tsunami aid, the war and the deficit, nominations to the cabinet and the federal judiciary, possibly including the Supreme Court. With enlarged majorities in both the House and Senate, Republicans control that agenda, while Democrats try to carve out a new role for themselves. There could be new tensions with the White House, too, from within the Republican Party. In a few minutes, we'll talk with several members of the House and Senate. Later in the program, a new proposal for the indefinite detention of some imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. But first, the 109th Congress. If you have questions about what's likely to happen in Congress this session, about partisan politics or the prospects for far-reaching reforms, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from the studios of the Washington Post is columnist David Broder, and it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation, David.
Neil, how are you?
Very well. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
We mentioned that there is an awful lot on the agenda. The president and the Republican Party got what they regarded as a mandate in November. How are they going to enact that?
Swiftly, if they can, because the history suggests that a president, particularly a second-term president, has his maximum influence the first year of that term. After that, the sands begin to run out on the time for him. So I think they will move quickly, and the president has signaled that he's going to go for the biggest and probably toughest prize right at the start, namely Social Security reform.
And Social Security reform is going to bring up another set of issues. That also goes to confirmations. They're going to start hearings on those this week. And that regards the procedures in the United States Senate, where effectively on all major votes, 40 senators can block passage of any measure.
That's right. And while the Republican majority in the Senate has the option at the beginning of the session tomorrow to try to change the rule that would cut off any filibuster possibility as far as the judicial nomination is concerned, the best information that I have is that they will not make that rules change tomorrow, but will hold off and see if the Democrats, in fact, are going to deploy the filibuster weapon again against these judicial nominees.
And the president reappointed, I think 20 overall of the men and women he wanted named to the federal court whose nominations had been blocked.
That's right. No backing off on his part.
So the president, after the election, said, we'll reach out to those who share our goals. Thus far, he doesn't seem to be giving an awful lot to the Democrats.
No, because as you know, he said at that press conference the other day, I don't want to negotiate with myself, which means that he will postpone it perhaps for some time, any concessions on either judicial appointments or the structuring of a Social Security change. But at some point, it's likely that he will have to come to terms with some Democrats on both of those subjects if he's going to be able to achieve most of his objectives.
He'll need 60 votes in the United States Senate for one, and for another, the Republican Party is not exactly totally unified on any of this.
No, and there's particularly is there nervousness, I think, among Republican members of Congress, I would say particularly in the House side, about the whole prospect of taking up the Social Security issue. The members know that they will be on the ballot in 2006. The president won't be on the ballot again ever. And so they are going to calculate this very much in terms of what they sense is the sentiment in their home district and listen to those views probably more closely than they listen to the wishes of the president.
And we're going to hear a lot of talk about, I guess it's an expression we hadn't heard for a while, deficit hawks.
Yes, because those folks, and there are numerous, particularly on the Republican side, but there are also Democratic deficit hawks. And the Republicans who worry about the budget and the debt that we're piling up for children and grandchildren really kind of bit their tongues in 2004 because they did not want to embarrass the president or make his reelection any more difficult than it was going to be anyhow. But now, freed of that inhibition, I think they will be much more vocal about insisting that serious steps be taken to begin to slow the hemorrhaging of money from the federal treasury.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Eric, who's calling us from Goble, Oregon.
Howdy.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. I am very concerned about the Republicans trying to go ahead as they and their ethics. Not only they're trying to go ahead and say one thing and do another, but now they're trying to go ahead and change the rules of I believe it's the Congress or the House, so that no one is accountable. And if they are, they just rewrite the laws.
David Broder, this has to do with the man widely credited for pretty much running the House of Representatives, Tom DeLay of Texas.
Yes. I don't understand why this moral majority right, who believes in the Bible and religion and everything, can go ahead and boldface just make up their own rules. And when someone lies and cheats and goes everything that supposedly they're against, let's just go ahead and say, well, we don't have to look at it. We don't have to deal with it.
Might want to drop a couple of allegedlies in there, but David Broder, what's going on here?
Well, what's happening here is that tonight the Republican majority in the House will caucus to discuss the rules that will be formally presented to the House at the opening session tomorrow. And the proposal that's going to come from the leadership of the Republican Party in the House is one that would, first of all, change the chairmanship of the House Ethics Committee. The man who's been the chairman, Joel Heffley of Colorado, has been a pretty tough and independent enforcer of the rules, and I think he's likely to be removed and replaced by somebody that the leadership believes may be more compliant, let's put it that way. The second change that will be before the caucus is one that would remove from the House rules a general statement that anybody whose actions or behavior reflect discreditably on the reputation of the House can be sanctioned by the House itself and by its ethics committee, so that the requirement would be that you find essentially some specific and probably criminal action before the House disciplined any of its members. And it will be interesting to see whether the House Republicans want to take that kind of broad step, which would really represent a significant weakening of the House Ethics Code.
Joining us now from his office on Capitol Hill, as we switch chambers for a moment, Republican Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire. Good of you to be with us on the program.
A pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And Happy New Year to you.
Oh, same to you.
With your party expanding control of both houses, and of course has the White House too, there's been talk of this as the right time to start spending some of the political capital voters gave you in November. What do you expect to really push for this session?
Well, of course, the overriding issue that we have to address as a country and as a Congress is how we protect ourselves in a time of very significant international threat through terrorism, and that'll be really dominating everything. But underneath that issue, there are a lot of major concerns that I think we have to address. The first is we've got to address the issue of controlling our spending and making sure that our deficits start to move down so that the dollar doesn't continue to weaken as a result of international markets having lack of faith in our currency, and so that we don't pass on to our children a dramatic amount of debt that they have to finance. We should be taking a hard look at this demographic tidal wave which is headed towards us, this huge generation, which I'm a member of, the baby boom generation, which is going to start retiring here in a few years and be such a large segment of the population drawing out of the economy that our younger people, our children and our children's children, will have a tough time supporting us in our retirement if we don't face up to the fact that both the health care system, which supports retirees, and the underlying system, Social Security, need some adjustment because of the size of this generation. And we should reform our tax laws to make them simpler, more responsible, and more easily understood. That's something that's easy to say and never seems to happen, but it's a worthwhile goal, a worthwhile purpose. Got a lot of work in the area of education, and we should need to take a hard look at trying to address tort activity in this country. The fact that we've become such a litigious society and so much of our productivity is frittered away in lawsuits that aren't necessarily contributing to either the betterment of society or making us more productive or competitive internationally.
As chairman of the Budget Committee, you're going to be talking about a lot of money issues for the next several years. The money for the war in Iraq is not included in the president's budget. Should it be?
Well, in the president's budget, I presume there will be a base number for national defense, which, of course, is in part an issue of fighting in Iraq, the basic national defense structure. I understand from the reports I've read from people like David Broder, who are very insightful and thoughtful reporters. Obviously, he's a leading reporter in the country on political issues, that there is the administration is going to move towards trying to reduce the rate of growth of the defense base, which will be something I'll be involved in as chairman of the Budget Committee and will support if the administration moves in that direction, may support even if they don't. As to fighting the war in Iraq, that's really has been funded outside the budget for the last 3 years, I suspect, or the last 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. I suspect that that will continue to be the case, primarily because it's a unique item. We are hoping that it is a one-time item, that it's not a continuing item, that we won't be in Iraq for an extended period of time, and that the cost of fighting that war, we have to spend what we have to spend in order to make sure our troops are properly maintained there and have the necessary systems to protect themselves. So it's pretty hard to budget for it in many ways.
Senator Gregg, again, we thank you for your time. Good luck with your struggles with the budget and on other issues this year.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Judd Gregg, Republican of New Hampshire, joined us from his office at the Capitol. We're going to continue with the, was that the best political reporter in the country, David Broder? When we come back from a short break, we're also going to be speaking with other members of the House and the United States Senate. As we continue to talk about the agenda of the 109th Congress, 800-989-8255, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing some of the big issues coming up this session of Congress with David Broder of The Washington Post. Of course, you're invited to join us. What issues are you keeping an eye on? Energy? Agriculture? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. David Broder, energy was one of the areas that the president did not get the bill out that he hoped for from the last Congress. They're going to try again?
They will try again, and I think the odds are pretty good that they will have a success this year. The Republicans' hand have been strengthened by the election results, particularly on the Senate side. And I think the urgency with which people all across the political spectrum now view the situation, particularly the nervousness about the possible disruption in Saudi Arabia, the single greatest source of our external source of our energy, really makes this a matter of priority. And I'm keeping fingers crossed, but I really do think that there is a good chance of a significant energy bill in this Congress.
And would that include drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge?
That's probably the hardest issue to for the Democrats to accept. But it may be that there is some way of compromising that or separating that from the other provisions of the bill. This is a comprehensive effort to try to look at all of the sources of energy, coal, oil, gas, and the more sustainable, renewable energy sources. And I think there is a sense now that a few controversial issues, such as drilling in Anwar, should not be allowed to prevent the whole bill from moving forward.
Joining us now is one of the new faces in the Senate chamber, though not new to Capitol Hill. Republican Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina joins us now, who spent 8 years in the House of Representatives. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Neil, it's great to be with you. It's good to be back for my swearing-in tomorrow.
Well, looking forward to it. What did you learn in the House of Representatives that you might bring over to the Senate side?
Well, I've learned that we've got a president who has the courage to confront some tough issues. He's got the vision to turn a lot of the problems into opportunities. And I learned that if you get out front with some ideas like Social Security and tax reform, that after a while people start listening. And so I'm encouraged as I go into the Senate that a lot of the things I worked on in the House are on the front burner right now, with the president being the number one cheerleader.
Do you regard yourself as more conservative than the president?
No, I think I don't know. It depends on how you define that word. But if I had a choice, I would certainly limit government and reduce the demand for government by making people free and secure in their own right. And that includes things like the president has talked about, like creating an ownership society. And instead of having a Social Security program that's unfunded and people are dependent on the government, we actually create savings and ownership. And that's what I mean by being conservative, is not making people less secure or taking something away from them, but making them more independent.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. Keon joins us from San Diego.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I just want to know, how aggressive is the new Congress going to be about illegal immigration, and why does there seem to be such a widening disconnect on how most Americans feel about it and how the elites in Washington, D.C. feel about it?
Well, that's a great question, and it will be at the top of the agenda, because it's something I heard about a lot in a campaign in South Carolina, and really I hear a lot from both sides. You've got business interests, whether they be tourism, hotels, or whatever. I mean, they need more labor in this country, and there are jobs Americans at least appear not to be willing to do, but the public in general is very concerned at the illegal immigration and the perceived cost that they think it has on our society. So I think it's an issue we're going to have to deal with. The president, again, has shown some courage in trying to at least send up a trial balloon that maybe there's some way to bring the illegals in this country into some kind of registration or something where we know who's there. But that's something a lot of people are opposed to, and I have my own concerns about it as well.
Keon, when you talk about the gap you're talking about, could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Well, I mean, again, the business interest and just the general voters, they have a completely different perspective. And we have everyone, again, from hospitals to small construction companies, large construction companies, are looking for people who will do manual labor. And they often find that in the immigrants who've come here to work. And some of those are legal and some are illegal, and it's very difficult for employers to tell the difference, because there's such good documentation among the illegals. But when the public perceives that this is a drain on our resources, whether it be health care, education, Social Security, Medicare, and while that's not necessarily true, I think a lot of people in this country are alarmed at the sheer numbers of illegals who are in this country.
Keon, thanks. Well,
if I may, really quickly, I just want to comment that the states themselves, I know as a Republican senator, you're probably really into states' rights and having strong states. But states like the one that I originally come from, Kentucky, they just don't have the money to have to accommodate to the challenges of incorporating millions or hundreds of thousands of new people into their state who have special needs.
Well, right, and states have to help, obviously, but it's a national security issue. We have to be able to control our borders. There can't be any question about that, and no one should support illegal immigration. And so we need to do what I talked about in the campaign. We've got to control our borders. We've got to know who's coming in, but at the same time, we've got to look at the economic interest of a lot of businesses who are telling us they can't find workers, if our guest worker program can be improved in some way.
Keon, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
And Jim DeMinta, we thank you for your time today. Good luck tomorrow. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed being on your show.
Jim DeMinta will be a freshman senator tomorrow from South Carolina. He joined us from here in Washington, D.C. Now joining us is Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. Welcome back to the program, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you and everybody there.
You're the ranking member, of course, on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Is this one of the places where Democrats are going to be exercising what little power they have on Capitol Hill?
Well, actually, I would hope that we have more than little power, just as I've been here several times in the majority, several times in the minority. I found, especially in the Senate, both the majority and the minority have power. I think a lot depends upon what the Republican Party wants. I mean, the Republicans do control the White House, the House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, and some would say the U.S. Supreme Court. The question is whether they want real cooperation, whether they want to work as a country, whether they want to be uniters, not dividers, or otherwise. So a lot of it's up to them. I mean, the president did get 51% of the vote, but there are 49% of the people voted for Senator Kerry. Obviously, they want to have a voice in what goes on in the country.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Jack, and Jack's calling from Columbus, Georgia.
Yeah, hey, Neil. Good to be on the show. If Mr. Broder's around, I loved hearing his comments on Meet the Press yesterday. My concern really was with the possibility of Bush appointing justices that will overturn Roe v. Wade. I'm a Catholic, and I voted for Kerry, but many of my parishioners voted along abortion lines and therefore voted for Bush, thinking he'd appoint justices to overturn the ruling. And it seems like with Rehnquist's possible departure, Bush will probably be successful in the promotion of Scalia to Chief Justice, but I can't imagine that the Senate will very easily confirm another justice as conservative as Rehnquist. So it seems like my fellow prisoners have wasted their vote if their motivation was, as I said.
Well, it's a couple of steps you've made there, Jack.
Several steps there. Obviously, if the president and the Republicans in the Senate felt as strongly about Roe versus Wade as they have said in all their speeches they do, they could simply introduce a constitutional amendment banning abortion in the United States and bring it to a vote. That would, if it succeeded, that would overturn Roe versus Wade. But every time that's been suggested from President Reagan's time on, they've made it very clear they'd rather talk about it than actually take that kind of step. So I don't think you're going to see a Supreme Court nominee being confirmed who's there for the express purpose of either overturning or of upholding Roe versus Wade.
Yeah, as a Catholic, I can't support abortion, but the issue seems to go past abortion. I guess you really hear people say that the issue is bigger than abortion. But the Supreme Court nominations, to me, are bigger than abortion because the people who would likely be in there to overturn Roe versus Wade also really have some other really damaging standpoints, in my view, for the rest of the nation. So
there are a whole lot of issues beyond just abortion that the Supreme Court has to deal with. You've mentioned what are the positions, for example, the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church opposes the death penalty. Certainly, that's an issue that comes before the Supreme Court. It's actually something voted on by members of Congress and members of the state legislature all the time. The Catholic position is very clear against the death penalty. Many of the people they support are for the death penalty. The Pope was opposed to the war in Iraq. That's probably not going to be before the Supreme Court. Will be an issue before the Congress. But I don't think that we should be looking at this as saying any particular religion or church should determine what is going to be the agenda of the Supreme Court. But I think that there are vacancies. That will be a major matter before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I think that the hearings and the debate will be very good. I think you're going to find that the people of this country will pay close attention, as they did at the time of Clarence Thomas and of others.
Quickly, Senator, do you think that Senator Frist is going to try to change the rules on cloture, cutting off debate?
Well, I mean, he can, if he wants to totally turn his back on not only constitutional practice, but on the rules of the Senate, he might be able to do that by majority. It'd be unfortunate because it would be he'd be saying, in effect, minority has no rights, and the Senate, the one parliamentary body that has always protected the rights of the minority, just as we Democrats did when we were in the majority, he wants to turn his back on it. As a practical matter, it'd be somewhat of a pyrrhic victory because 95% of the work done in the Senate is done by unanimous consent. If he doesn't have that, he could find that it would take 6 months to do what we normally do in a week.
And quickly, I know you're working on an aid package for tsunami victims. How quickly do you think that might go through?
Well, I think one will go through very quickly. Of course, the White House can, the president has at least $300 million that he could move at his own discretion immediately. That's why I was somewhat critical when first the White House was saying $15 million, then $35 million. I said, look, we got the authority to move $300 immediately. We can reprogram some of those billions of dollars that are not being spent in Iraq and probably never will be spent in Iraq. This is not money for our troops, but the so-called reconstruction money that's mm-hmm. not being spent. And we should be doing that. Now, what we are doing, and I applaud the leadership for doing this, is moving our military, our heavy lift capability, our helicopters, and others into these areas, because it's not so much the aid, which will be necessary years from now, it's the aid immediately to keep people from dying from starvation, from dehydration, or from the diseases like cholera and others, dysentery, that follow something this cataclysmic.
Senator Leahy, thank you very much, and again, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you for calling.
Patrick Leahy of Vermont, who joined us from his office on Capitol Hill. And now another Republican senator, Charles Grassley of Iowa. And welcome back to the program, Senator Grassley. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, and I hope you had a Merry Christmas.
I think I wish you the same. You're going to be the chairman of the Finance Committee. A whole lot of major questions. Talk to us a little bit about the deficit. How do you get spending down in the midst of a war?
Yeah. Well, of course, it's very difficult. And if we had worried about the deficit in World War II, Hitler would have been in New York City. So you put all the resources behind the men and women that you have on the battlefield, or you shouldn't. But hopefully, January 30th, when they have the election in Iraq, there, we'll see some turning. And without even that, though, it seems like we're on a path of increasing the number of Iraqi troops and policemen, and as they go up, naturally our numbers would go down.
Let's get a caller on the line with you. This is Dave. Dave's calling from Overland Park in Kansas.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing today?
Very well,
thanks. My question is much like your first question is, basically Congress and the President have a lot they want to do this session, yet how are we going to pay for it? And also, that comes back to the weakness of the dollar, and could you talk about that, please?
Yeah, you're going to pay for the functions of government by taxes, probably the present level of taxation. You're going to pay by the defense on borrowed money. And we're going to cut back domestic expenditures, as you would in any time of war, to probably 1% increase like we had this year compared to the 8 or 9% increases we inherited from the Clinton administration, or maybe even go below that to a freeze of across the board in domestic expenditures. The value of the dollar will be decided by the marketplace.
But more borrowing is unlikely to move the value of the dollar upwards, Senator.
It would move the value of the dollar down probably, but one sure thing that would hurt the value of the dollar is when people start taking protection against the dollar if they see political manipulation of it. So we have to use the monetary policies of the Fed and the fiscal and taxation policies of the Congress in a way that are seen as normal use of those powers without being seen as manipulating the value of the dollar.
Senator, we also have David Broder with us earlier. He was saying that he thinks the president's and the Republican leadership is going to move first on the Social Security. Down the road, there are tax reform issues as well. Do you expect to see those this year?
Well, at the very least, if we want to have our children and grandchildren having the same good Social Security that my generation has, and near retirees right now are going to have, we have to rebuild Social Security from an era that it was first built when we had 40 workers paying into a pay-as-you-go system for every person coming out of it, down to a point where we have three now. And when the baby boomers go into retirement, we'll probably have just a little over two workers paying into it. It's quite obvious you can't keep up the same system with 40 workers paying in it per retiree to three workers paying into it per retiree.
Dave, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And Senator Grassley, thank you as always for your time today.
Okay, goodbye.
Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa. We still have David Broder with us and more of your questions when we come back from a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now, we'll finish up our conversation about the issues Congress will take up when they return to session tomorrow. Our guest is columnist David Broder of The Washington Post. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email TOTN at NPR.org. And David, we have to apologize for ignoring you. We got several senators there.
You had some very interesting comments from the senators.
And as you listen to what they have to say, it's interesting. Discipline and focus have been hallmarks of this White House. Are they going to be able to bring the same kind of discipline and focus to this congressional session?
They will attempt to, but I thought that what Jim DeMint was saying about making his own judgments about the immigration issue, for example, is kind of a signal to the White House that they cannot expect just lockstep conformity from Republican members of Congress on contentious issues where the members are hearing things from back home, as Senator DeMint said he's hearing in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. And as you look ahead to this fight on Social Security, there's going to be all kinds of proposals. Who is going to be pushing what will be seen as the White House's ideas?
Well, the president has a ways to go to spell out his own proposal. As you know, up to this point, he has talked about the principles that are important to him, but he hasn't put it together in a plan that people can actually measure or begin to figure out the costs. And I would think that the Congress is going to want to hear more from the president before they really begin to move on Social Security legislation.
Let's take another caller. Aaron is with us from Bloomington, Delaware.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I'm in Wilmington.
Wilmington, excuse me.
My question is about the future of gay marriage in this new Congress. It seemed like the campaign with Cheney and Bush kind of giving mixed messages on the constitutional amendment, and so many members of Congress claiming at least that they received a mandate against gay marriage. How is that going to shape up in the new Congress? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Aaron.
My guess is that there will not be a constitutional amendment on gay marriage. I think that what's happened in the state initiatives or referenda on the issue sends a very clear message that at least in many parts of the country, most parts of the country, the public is not yet ready to support that concept. But Congress is institutionally conservative, and I think for good reasons, about trying to change the Constitution of this country. And I'd be surprised if there are 2/3 of the votes in the House or the Senate to launch such an amendment. And as you know, it would then require a ratification by 3/4 of the legislatures.
And there are some who would say the Republicans would prefer to have this as an issue than as a constitutional amendment.
I think this is one where probably the public over time will begin to adjust to the concept of same-sex couples, whether they actually allow a marriage or not. In many places, I've been surprised to see the degree of support for some form of recognition of those arrangements that falls short of the term marriage. Marriage is an emotionally and culturally freighted term, and I think the consensus in this country probably is at this point, let's not punish people who wish to find their personal happiness with somebody of the same sex, but we're not prepared to say that it's interchangeable with marriage as we've known it in the past.
One final question for David Broder. Dave is with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering if y'all thought that there was a possibility of any substantive healthcare legislation would come about. You know, for us, for our family personally, we've seen our health insurance cost increase to the point where they're almost 8% of our gross income. And both my wife and I work full time. And we have a high deductible in order to save, and it's even been difficult to get the insurance that we have. It's just really gotten to the point where, the health care costs are a far greater tax, if you will, than increased fuel costs, which have been so commonly referred to as a tax.
What you're experiencing, I think, is an almost universal experience now in this country. It's affecting families. It's affecting small business. It's affecting big business. The auto manufacturers are screaming for relief from the health care costs of their current employees and their retirees because it puts them at a huge competitive disadvantage in world markets. So I think the pressure is really on for the Congress to try to step up to the whole issue of health reform. States are hurting in their budgets because of the runaway costs in the Medicaid program. And I think the reality is beginning to sink in that we have essentially a dysfunctional health care system in this country, one that is overly expensive and far less productive of results in terms of improved health.
Dave, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And David Broder, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Take good care.
David Broder, columnist and reporter with The Washington Post, and he joined us from their studios here in Washington, D.C.